Give us an update on the Hollow Earth. We talked about that a couple of years ago. Where does that stand right
now? Oh, sure. For your listeners that might not be familiar with the whole program, this was something that was put together by Stephen Curry and Rodney Clough. And I actually joined the team in 2005 to be a part of the gyroscope team to measure the curvature of the Earth, because one of the things we realize is if we're sailing on the sea, we're not going to be able to actually sail up on the hole. It might be several hundred miles across.
You go right into it, not even know it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we needed to measure the curvature of the Earth, and it was the only way that we could accurately determine to measure it. So that went along fine until the fall of 2006, August of 2006, we discovered that Stephen Curry had very suddenly and unexpectedly passed away, rapidly advancing brain cancer. I mean, it just totally took us by surprise. So about 5 weeks later, I was elected by the board to be the expedition leader. And my goodness, life took on a completely different angle after that. To take a scientific tack at something that has such a metaphysical, mythical air about it, going all the way back to, I guess, Edmund Halley in 1629 was the first really credible scientist to think about and pontificate on the idea that Earth might be hollow. Since then, of course, we've got advanced science, and we know that we float around on the Earth on top of tectonic plates like cornflakes in a bowl of milk. And we have tied together all of the USGS, that's the United States Geological Survey. These are listening stations all around the world, tied together real time. So every time there's a really hard earthquake, we sort of do an MRI or a CAT scan of the Earth. We get a good picture of it. Interestingly enough, though, as we began looking at the readouts from this, we call seismograms, and analyzing them, the vibrations were showing up at listening stations mysteriously. So we kind of had to, you know, go along with geologists as they theorized that these vibrations ended up at these listening stations by taking what they call shadow paths or shadow waves through the Earth. All of this was done, of course, to support their idea that the Earth is built of tectonic plates floating around on a molten pool of magma. However, when you take all of the sciences, cosmology and oceanography and the seismology together, it started painting a little different picture, a more confusing picture, one that was less sure that the Earth was built the way the geologists say it's built. It left a window of opportunity to think about the idea that planets might form as hollow spheres. The bottom line is there wasn't enough data to make a decision. And when we discovered that actually no one had been above the Arctic Circle by sea, at least no one that was going to talk about it, it really put a challenge before us. Mm-hmm. Like Mount Everest, we were standing before it, insatiable mountain climbers. And so we began to find a way to try to go to the north, to go above the Arctic Circle and check this out. Well, as it turns out, during the same period of time, 2006 until now, there's been quite a squabble over who owns the continental shelf up there. I can tell you right now that the Russians have won the argument hands down. Nobody is going to sail above San Yosef Islands except the Russians. We've tried. We've tried to charter larger ships out of Norway that have ice-rated hulls, and they will not go above the 80th parallel. So
they won't go, or they can't go?
They won't go.
Okay.
They will not violate Russian waters. And so that leaves us one company, one shipping company, and that's called the Murmansk Shipping Company. They used to have a large fleet of nuclear icebreakers. Now they only have two. That's the Arctica and the Sevmorput. Now the Captain Kolibnikov is run by Quark Expeditions. It's a diesel ship, and it can get up there, but it can't stay a long time. We want to stay 12 days, so we make sure that we completely vet this idea that there might be an opening at the Arctic Circle into the inner Earth. Well, in order to charter one of these ships, it's about $2 million. That's a big expedition. So, of course, we went to Discovery Channel and History Channel and National Geographic Channel, and, of course, they were wonderfully interested in our project after it was completed, of course.
Sure.
So various tactics, methods, and processes we tried to raise enough money to do the expedition really did not pan out. And that's just the bottom line. It would, I think, make a great film. It would make a great adventure. Certainly, it would make the most rare expedition ever done. And here is where it really gets interesting. Both of these ships, the Arctica and the Sevmaport, are going to be decommissioned in 2012. So we're planning for the summer solstice, perhaps, of 2012 to shoot for the Arctic Circle.
So you haven't given up on it yet?
No, we haven't given up on it until the last ship sails, I guess.
If it's hollow, Brooks, do you think NASA knows about it?
Well, I can tell you that NASA suspects it, because when the pictures started coming in showing that we have auroras over both poles at the same time, the idea that auroras are caused only by the solar wind got thrown out the window. There were some scientists that said, well, you know, when the solar wind hits in the northern hemisphere, it kind of hits the magnetic field and goes around the Earth and forms auroras on both poles. But when we run a scatter plot between the presence of sufficient solar wind coming from coronal holes on the sun or solar flares and the actual appearance of the auroras, they don't line up. Sometimes they do, but most of the time they don't. What we find is that the energy that it takes to make the auroras, make the ionosphere put off light above both poles, doesn't come from outside the Earth. It comes from inside the Earth. So when that was discovered, NASA put together, and Jet Propulsion Labs, a probe called the Themis probe. It was a single capsule with five satellites in it. Those satellites were launched in 2008. In 2009, they got into position. There was an amazing explosion between satellites 3 and 4 headed out to space. The explosion went out to space past satellite 4 and 5 and also toward Earth past satellites 3, 2, and 1. And when it struck the Earth, boom, there was the aurora. So rather than repeat the experiment, NASA published right away. This is what it said in the article. We know what causes auroras now. It is caused from cosmic bullets. Cosmic bullets, little invisible bombs left behind by the sun. And with no apparent rhyme or reason, they just pop into existence, explode, and cause the auroras either over the North or South Pole.
Like fireworks.
Like cosmic invisible fireworks.
Yeah.
I thought the article was ridiculous. I'm not an astronomer, but I am a physicist, and I can tell you it didn't hold water for me. So, and they've never repeated it, even though those satellites are still up there. So NASA's concerned about it. They don't have all the answers, and they're trying to, you know, sort of publish the best that they can to keep people at least aware of what they're doing.
And the hole is 200 miles wide, do you think? That's pretty small, I guess.
It's pretty small when you compare it to the Earth.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people say, well, gee, why don't you just wait till a polar satellite goes over? Take a picture of it. But in 2006, February of 2006, the NOAA and EUMETSAT, these are the two controlling bodies for all of the weather satellites that go around the Earth right now, passed the Data Denial Act. This forbids information, real-time data or pictorial information, from being fed from weather satellites to the public above the 60th parallels. So we can't see what's on the North Pole. There are no publicly available images of the North Pole.